following program may contain traces of irony, sarcasm, satire, parody, mockery, banter, caricature, and nuts. The opinions expressed are almost certainly not shared by self-appointed officious dictatorial wowsers. If you are dangerously irony deficient or allergic to mockery of the self-important and corrupt, then get a life.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Environmental as Anything, the place where we get a life, or at least we stand up for the life here on our Mother Earth. And in all throughout the universe, for that matter, wherever it may be found, which, you know, at this point, obviously, still just here on Mother Earth. So, all life in the universe, our remit, I should say thank you, respects to elders past, present and emerging of the Bundjalung Nation, where I live, work and play. This is stolen land, always was and always will be the property of the Bundjalung people. So here we are. I've got a huge show, as always say, and it's always true. We've got a huge show lined up today. I'm really excited to say I've got Professor David Lindenmeyer, who is one of, well, perhaps the world's leading expert on Australian forest ecology. He's been studying, researching and teaching about this, writing and thinking about the issues of our forests and how to sustain those vitally important features of our ecosystems and our life support system. And he's recently released a new book, which is absolutely terrific. People are very excited about it. There's a real buzz around the forest wars. And so, yes, as the author of The Forest Wars, David Lindenmeyer will be joining us later in the show to talk about the ugly truth about what's happening in our tall forests. And, yes, so very excited to have Professor Lindenmeyer joining us today. I've got someone on the line who's done nothing but good work, as far as I'm aware, over the last 40 years. Professor David Lindenmeyer is a world-leading expert on forest and woodland ecology, resource management, conservation science and biodiversity conservation. He's based at the Australian National University and has led some of the largest long-term research programs in Australia for more than 40 years. He's among the world's most productive and most highly cited scientists, particularly on forest ecology and conservation. So it's a great pleasure to have him with us to talk to us about The Forest Wars, his new book, hot off the press, which is subtitled The Ugly Truth About What's Happening in Our Tall Forests. David, thank you very much for joining Environmental as Anything today.
It's a pleasure, Sean. Thank you.
Look, your book has been hotly anticipated in the forest protection movement, I've got to say. I know that quite a few people have been recommending that I read it. People locally here in the Lismore Fridays for Forest group have had hold of it and have been excited by the content, the density of information that's involved, and also the light touch you have with presenting it. It makes it quite accessible to be able to understand the complex issues of forest ecology and politics. So thank you, first off, for doing such great work for so long.
Thank you. I have to give a shout out to my publisher and my wife, both of whom can edit better than I can write. So
it's good to have a good team. It's good to have some backup with good people behind you. That sounds very helpful. Look, you mentioned in the introduction to the book, you know, like your first day working in the forests, winter 1983. You know, you've been out there, like doing the hard yards in those forests for a long time, and you sort of conclude that a bit, or at least you mention in that introduction, I think your children, your son, was it that you had out in the forest with you in your arms with a greater glider? Can you tell us a little bit more about your personal connection with those forests, please?
Oh, yeah. So I first started working in the wet forests of Victoria in July 1983. And it was distinctly etched in my mind because by the end of the day, when I'd finished putting out traps in the forest, I thought it was time for a shower. So I stripped off all my wet weather gear because it had been raining all day. And I jumped in the shower and it was like a scene out of a horror movie because I was just hemorrhaging blood everywhere because there was leeches attached all around my neck, and I sort of realised later that I actually need to take steps to make sure that I don't lose my entire quota of blood supply. Mm. And yeah, I sort of maintained a sort of a a grudging respect for leeches and their ability to get into all sorts of nooks and crannies that they probably shouldn't be in while you're working in the forest.
Well, it is hard work, and it can be dirty and exhausting, and even with leeches and other even more dangerous critters out there, sometimes people are a bit frightened of our forests, aren't they? But there's more than fear and darkness in the forest, which we've got from fairy tales and from Sherwood Forest, etc. There's not just outlaws lurking out there so much anymore as the beauty and wonder that you've found as well, isn't there? Along with, as I say, your baby son in your arms.
Absolutely. It's my favourite place to work, and it has been for a long time. And really learning to understand how the forest works, being able to understand how the plants and the animals interact in these amazing systems, and to recognise how extraordinary Australia's forests are. You know, we have the tallest flowering plants in the world. We have the world's most carbon-dense forests. We have some of the highest biodiversity forests anywhere on the planet. And you know, the kind of understanding that comes with being able to work in these extraordinary places for such a long time is fantastic. And, you know, really I've led such a privileged life that the taxpayer has paid my salary for many, many, many years, and I'm enormously appreciative of that privilege.
Mm. Well, I think those who know your work would appreciative of the fact that you've been able to do it. But the look, you've structured your book around the idea of myths. You've got 37 myths listed, and I'm not going to be able to go through them all, unfortunately. We don't have sufficient time or perhaps attention for that. People will have to get the book themselves to get to those. I've got a couple here marked off, but what made you, so I wanted to go through maybe a few of them, but what made you think about the forest in terms of myths? I mean, aside from its, you know, the mythological, you know, like associations that people have with forest, not dryads and nymphs and et cetera, but why are these modern myths sort of driving your narrative?
Oh, well, I think what's happened over the last 40 years is that I just heard so many mistruths about what's really happening, you know, how we have to log forests because we have to protect communities, when the reality is that forests become more flammable the more you log them, how we have to log forests to build houses, with the reality that native forest logging generates mostly wood chips and paper pulp, and most of our housing timber actually comes from plantations, how we have to log forests to save the climate, when in fact logging generates enormous amounts of emissions and it's really bad for the climate, and it's much better if we maintain forests in an intact state. Mm. All of those kinds of things sort of perpetrated the situation. It wasn't very long ago that I was sitting in a Senate committee and the same old myths came out over and over again, how the industry puts bread on the table for tens of thousands of Australian families. Mm. In fact, it employs very few people. How we have to log forests because they're so dangerous for fire reasons. In fact, they're more flammable when we log them, all those kinds of things. So I just thought it was time to put all of this in one place, but then also paint a picture for people at the end of the book about how there's actually a much, much better outcome here. If we exit native forest logging and we move to a plantation-only industry, we can be in a far better place in terms of jobs, in terms of our economy, in terms of our environmental credentials. And we can meet our greenhouse gas emissions targets.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does seem to me, I've been involved in forest politics for longer than I care to mention almost, but it's 35 years or so, but it's been in that time, and it's become very clear that the thing that the native forest logging industry produces more efficiently than anything else is lies. And more kindly, perhaps, myths. So, yeah, I can see how that you know, frustrating that would be for you when you're actually out there finding the truth in those forests and hearing it, you know, pilloried or speared on these sharpened points of these lies. So maybe we could just talk through like a few of them. I've just marked off a few off your list that I thought we might be able to go to. And I thought number one was a great place to start. You know, the logging industry likes to say, don't worry about a thing, the forest will grow back after we've smashed it.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, when I used to hear these kinds of things when I was first doing forestry units back in the early 1980s, look, we only log a little bit of the forest, it grows back, the animals just move away and they come back. There's not, you know, don't you worry about a thing, as, you know, Joe Bielke Peterson used to say. We've got it under control. And the reality is that many animals die on site when you log a forest. Mm-hmm. The best bits of the landscape are cut. Many species will take decades, if not hundreds of years, to recover. So the impacts are really quite profound. And they're very long-lasting and over very large scales. And so this idea that it's benign, we only log a small bit of the landscape in any given year, actually doesn't add up. It's a real myth. It's a true lie once you start to put it together. And the data, the scientific evidence shows that quite comprehensively.
Yeah, I mean, like just going for a walk in the forest, as I say, I'm no scientist, but I can walk through the forest and use my eyes. And I've noticed in talking to people about forests that they refer to regrowth, thinned out and depleted and clearly, stunted forests as young forests. They tend to assume that, this is because it's young and it will grow back, according to the myth. But I've taken to saying to people, no, these are ancient forests that have been made forced to regress into this stunted state by the treatment they've received. It's not just some sort of natural state that they're in. It's actually a state of collapse.
That's right. What we often see is that log forests are highly simplified, so they're missing the important elements like large old trees, wet mesic understories with tree ferns and other plants, including rainforest plants. The structure of the forest has changed quite dramatically. The soils are quite depleted in key elements such as carbon, ammonium, boron, other kinds of things. So there are some fundamental changes from the soils to the trees, the understories to the animals. And really, I thought it was very important in the book to indicate to people that, you know, these are comprehensive changes. And in many cases, certainly for some of the mammals, they actually die on site. They don't pack up and leave and move elsewhere. They actually die, and it's also an animal welfare issue.
Absolutely, and people are a bit reluctant to even face that horror that's really going on out there, but it's interesting to hear you putting it so clearly. The forestry departments do proper pre-logging surveys for animals. That's a commonplace misunderstanding, isn't it? It's well-established myth.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. This has been revealed, for example, in court cases in Victoria, but also more recently in New South Wales. You know, there were surveys done for greater gliders, which is a nocturnal animal, but they were daytime surveys and no individuals were seen. Well, of course, they're in the few remaining hollow trees that are in the landscape. If you don't look properly, you don't find. You're doing surveys for swift parrots in December when they're in Tasmania, but they didn't turn up in New South Wales. Gosh. What a surprise. What could possibly go wrong? And I think this is part and parcel of the deeper systemic problems in the industry, is that the industry is not economically viable, which means that there has to be corners cut. And some of the corners that are cut are the ones around doing proper pre-logging surveys, which means that places are being logged now that shouldn't be because of their high conservation value.
Yep. And then, of course, the timber issue. People think of forest products as basically exclusively, in most people's minds, they think first and foremost about wood. And so most wood cut in logging coops gets milled for sawn timber is a commonplace myth that people think that it's used for building houses and that it's all very productive and important and essential to our well-being and comfort. What have you got to say about all that?
Well, the sad reality is that the vast majority of native forest logging generates wood chips and paper pulp in most states. And it's been that way for a very, very long time. At the time that the industry supposedly closed in Victoria, 88% of all sawn timber that makes floorboards, roof trusses, furniture, those kinds of products, was already coming from plantations. It was the same in New South Wales. And the reality is that the vast majority of wood is going to wood chips and paper pulp. So these are very high volume, very low value timber products. And it's one of the reasons, again, why the industry simply is not economically viable and it cannot survive without being propped up with massive subsidies from government. So in New South Wales, in 2019-20, the Forestry Corporation was handed the best part of $250 million worth of subsidies from the taxpayer, and it still made a loss of nearly $30 million. Mm. And this is a story that's replicated in Tasmania, Western Australia, Victoria, over and over again. And so the taxpayer is essentially having to pay for the quote-unquote privilege of having their forest cut down to employ precious few people.
Mm. Yeah, your book's very clear about this. It's actually quite eye-opening. It's only been recently, as I say, I've been at it for decades, but I've just recently worked out or come to understand the fact that, 60% of the trees that are actually cut down in the forest are left as debris, as piles of... I mean, I've seen those piles and I've never really known, but it's over... It's 60% or more of the actual biomass is left behind in the forest, and only 40% is ever even taken out of the forest as logs. It's a staggering level of waste, isn't it?
That's right. So these are for tall wet forests, particularly Tasmania and Victoria, but also in some parts of New South Wales. So these are the tree heads, the lateral branches, the bark, the understory, the tree ferns, those kinds of things that are not taken off site.
Mm.
And so the tonnage can be colossal. So in some places, the amount of biomass that's left in the forest can be up to 450 tonnes per hectare.
Mm.
And so this is quite extraordinary, because when you then burn some of that logging slash, that debris, and volatilise significant parts of it as part of the greenhouse gas emissions, we see in places like Tasmania, logging industry is equivalent to about 1 million cars of emissions every year. Victoria, in the previous years, 730,000 motor vehicle emissions equivalent. So, these are non-trivial greenhouse gas emissions that are taking place all over Australia. And this is why we know that if we exit native forest logging, Australia actually reaches its greenhouse gas emissions pretty straightforwardly. And we've got some left over to offset some of the other issues that... taking place, for example, in the transport sector.
It's an extraordinary opportunity going begging, just being left on the table, isn't it? It really does beg a belief. But, again, another thing that people are told and taught to believe by the logging industry, by those who profit from this carnage, is that forests are made less flammable by logging, that if we thin them, they'll become less fire-prone. Is that also untrue?
That's precisely the case. It is untrue. So there were some debates following the 2009 fires in Victoria, which tragically killed more than 160 people. But if we log forests, then they'll be less flammable, and none of that carnage and that catastrophe would have happened. Once we started to look at this in some detail, we discovered, to our horror, that forests that had been logged and then regenerated were more flammable for 40 years after the logging had taken place. But the University of Wollongong, looking at a separate data set for New South Wales, discovered that extra flammability was in excess of 70 years. So if we were out logging forests in New South Wales now and cutting the forest down, we would leave it more fire prone until almost the end of this century. And what we discovered after the Black Summer fires was that logged forests always burnt at higher severity than intact forests. But the impact was so strong that log forests burning under moderate fire weather still burnt at higher severity than intact forests burning under extreme conditions.
Wow.
So this is a really important outcome, because it indicates that we need to be very careful about logging that's taking place near human communities, whether it's Mooloolambah or near Maruya or Mogo or wherever it is across New South Wales. We saw this effect in northern New South Wales as well as southern New South Wales.
Yep.
As well as in Victoria.
I think we could mention Rapville in this context as being one of those places where the most intense fires went around, and it prides itself on being a timber community, but it's the forests around it have been severely logged and were insanely flammable during the 2019-20 bushfires, so almost wiped out the town. Anyway, plenty of examples like that, aren't there?
There are, sadly, and it occurs for several reasons that people need to understand. One is the amount of logging slash that is left in the forest adds to fuel load, something that we talked about just a few minutes ago. But we also know that forests that are logged are hotter, they're also drier, and microclimatic conditions are also more variable. The architecture of the forest has also changed, so it becomes a very dense, thickened stand. And that's led to some people saying, oh, well, we can solve the problem by thinning the forest. Well, when we've done empirical studies on thinning, we discover that thinning either makes no difference or, in some cases, actually makes the forest more flammable. Mm. So the reality here is that logging and thinning, or thinning is really just the form of logging,
yeah,
both make forests more flammable. And we simply can't afford to be making forests more flammable when we have the pressures of climate change that are weighing in on top of this as well.
Mm. Okay, and another one that I've encountered plenty of times, which to some frustration, is the without native forest logging will bring imports that kill orangutans. Essentially, they're saying if you don't let us exterminate the gliders and the koalas, then we're going to go somewhere else and murder orangutans.
Yeah, look, I've heard that over and over again. After it was announced that the logging industry in Victoria was supposedly closing, you know, the former forestry minister for the state said he was weeping tears for the dead orangutans in Borneo, and it's kind of like, what on earth are you talking about? This is absolutely ridiculous. You already know that 90% of your industry is already wood chips and paper pulp,
mm.
So we're not going to be importing that kind of material from Asia. Although, quite amazingly now, we are importing plantation eucalypt wood chips from places like Vietnam, even though we're now exporting 97% of our own plantation eucalypt pulp logs overseas. So, you know, the whole structure of the industry is absolutely crazy.
Mm.
But the vast majority of our imports are coming from, quote-unquote, tropical countries like New Zealand.
Right.
So, you know, this is just, and all you need to do is spend literally no more than about 5 minutes looking at the federal government's data sets, and you see where are the imports coming from and what are we exporting. So in a state like Victoria grew 3.5 million tonnes of plantation eucalypt pulp logs, and then it exported 2.5 million tonnes, so three quarters of it got sent off to Asia, and in many cases we were buying back paper and packaging materials from Japan and China.
Mm.
It's just absolute insanity. And the reality is that Australia needs to have a wood reserve, a plantation wood reserve, so that we can maintain some of this timber in the country and process it in Australia for Australian jobs and Australian products.
Mm-hmm. And as for the orangutan population of New Zealand, I think they're probably safe from the logging industry there anyway.
Well, I think the important thing to recognise is that in many cases our own Australian native forest logging operations are not well regulated.
Mm.
But even over and above that, there are fewer swift parrots in Australia than there are orangutans in Borneo.
Mm.
Doesn't mean that I'm not concerned about ensuring that we conserve orangutans. Absolutely, we need to do that.
Mm.
But for God's sake, we need to look at it in our own backyard and what's happening to animals like swift parrots, what's happening to animals like greater gliders, and do the right thing by our own biodiversity.
Mm.
And the reality is that we don't need to be logging native forests in Australia anymore. We can get everything we need from plantations.
Mm, mm. Look, another great hoary old chestnut is the best way to tackle climate change is to cut down forests and regrow them.
Oh, gosh, the number of times I've had to that ridiculous myth. What's happening here is that people are failing to understand the difference between a stock and a flow. So we know that young forests grow quickly, and they store carbon as they grow quickly. But the young forests store long-term a lot less carbon than old forests. So when we log forests, we generate lots and lots of emissions.
Mm.
That's why we need to leave forests as intact ecosystems. And we also know that we generate a lot less carbon emissions when we extract our wood from plantations than we do from native forests, particularly given the amount of logging debris that's created from logging operations in native forests versus what happens in plantations. So long-term carbon storage is always significantly greater in intact forests than it is in logged and regenerated forests.
Mm.
And that's been shown over and over again.
Mm.
And I think it's been deliberately misinterpreted by industry players. This is especially important when you think about what most native forest logging is doing, and that's creating wood chips and paper pulp, box liners and packaging, which by and large has a very short time in the carbon life cycle before it goes to landfill and starts generating extra emissions.
Mm. Yeah, well, yeah, so that sort of puts that to bed. What about the last one I think on your list was particularly apposite. The politicians keep their promises about preserving forests. That's a great myth. I like it.
Yes, it is. And somebody else said the other day, I should have had a 38 myth, which were, trust us, we're from the government.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, I've been party to these kinds of things. In 2014, a former state minister for the environment said that they were going to declare a Great Forest National Park in Victoria. It was going to happen. Here we are almost 10 years later and nothing's happened. And, you know, we're seeing exactly the same kinds of stalling tactics from the Minns government in New South Wales about, you know, kicking the notion of a great koala national park into the long grass. And so, you know, there were all sorts of promises made and then there's sort of backsliding and then hand-wringing and all this kind of stuff. And in the process of doing that, forestry agencies then move in and concentrate their logging operations in some of these places of high conservation value, for example, around the area of the Great Koala National Park. Mm. I've seen that over and over again, hopefully to create the narrative, oh, look at how disturbed it is. There's no way you should put that in a national park. The cynicism is phenomenal. Mm. And the reality here is that these kinds of things are appalling management of a really important natural asset. And, you know, I just reiterate that there is no need to be logging native forests in Australia anymore.
Mm-hmm. No. All right. I'm convinced. I think you'll probably find the listeners are convinced too. And but the beautiful thing, one of the beautiful things about the book is you have a new vision for Australia's native forests. You conclude with, on a positive note, looking forward with to this new vision. Can you quickly outline that for us?
Yes, I think the vision is that if we exit native forest logging, we can reach our greenhouse gas reduction targets and pretty straightforwardly. We can then start to see investment flow into the plantation sector, as happened in New Zealand when they exited native forest logging more than 20 years ago. We can start to see investment in nature-based tourism and other activities. But there's also opportunities here to invest in carbon storage. Now, we don't have to trade carbon, but we can include carbon in our accounts and make a difference in that space. Mm. We'll also need elite firefighting because we've led to systems that are now much more flammable than they would have been 100, 200 years ago. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. We need to invest in these natural assets because they really are important, but they're also a source of enormous opportunity and wealth for rural and regional Australia and other parts of Australia. So there's enormous opportunities here for work, for regional renewal, for meeting our climate change targets, for meeting our biodiversity conservation targets, but also meeting our reserve targets. You know, the federal government has said there'll be no more extinctions. They've also had what's called a 30-30 target, which is 30% of Australia conserved by 2030. Well, if we take our native forests out of logging and put them into reserves, then we're going to get very close on that, which would be very, very important to contribute to stopping biodiversity loss on this continent.
Mm. Yes, it's grand sounding promises from politicians need to be pushed through, don't they? They need to be pushed all the way along to actually honouring those promises. But if they do, there's a lot of upside for us all.
Absolutely, and we'll stop the hemorrhaging of huge amounts of money. You know, in Tasmania, there's been a lot of hoo-ha over building a new stadium and all those kinds of things. Well, you know, Tasmania has the opportunity here to avoid continuing making massive losses. You know, the industry in Tasmania has cost that state over $1.5 billion. Mm. You know, in Victoria, there's been $875 million of handouts in the last few years alone. Mm. You know, this is a significant amount of money that can be used not only to invest in forests, but also to invest in doctors, nurses, aged care places, schools, you name it. Mm. And you know, Australian politicians need to be pushed to make better decisions, smarter decisions that employ people in better jobs, longer lasting jobs, and take us to a different future, a much better future than the one that we've got at the moment.
Well, that is an inspiring vision for the future, David. So thank you for sharing it with us here on Environmental as Anything today. And thank you for all of the decades of hard work that's gone into producing the culminating with this book, the Forest Wars. So we appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you. Great to chat to you.
Yeah, good luck with everything. We'll talk again sometime.
Thank you very much. See you later.
See ya.
Bye.
That was Professor David Lindenmayer, the author of The Forest Wars, The Ugly Truth About What's Happening in Our Tall Forests. And, one of the world's leading experts on forest and woodland ecology. So a great honour to have him here with us. I'd suggest getting out to the bookshop. I know the book warehouse in Lismore has got The Forest Wars on the Forest Wars on the shelf. So, race down there and grab them before they're sold out. I think the first print run is actually just about sold out, so they won't be able to restock for a little while. So get down there and grab them before somebody else does, because it's absolutely rip-roaring read about, the lungs of the earth, our life support system, and the future for us all. Well, you're tuned in to Environmental as Anything. Thank you very much for being with me today. I'm Sean O'Shaughnessy. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Environmental as Anything podcast. I'll be bringing them to you as regularly as I can. If you'd like to tune in to more of this kind of material, there's plenty of episodes available. You can subscribe to our podcast, and while you're there, you might as well rate it and help spread the word by sharing it on social media if you can. We're on social media, of course, on Facebook particularly. You can find us anywhere you look for Environmental as Anything. And if you're really keen to see the show carry on, please do go and support us on Patreon. Again, you can find us by just searching Environmental as Anything Patreon. Thank you for your support. Be gentle with yourselves, be kind to each other, and remember, we are all in this together.